Yeah, they give us, they allowed each one of us $5 a piece.
Okay.
And I had a sister who lived in San Anselmo, and I called her up and went out there, and my brother-in-law, he worked in the shipyard, and I borrowed $50 off of him.
Mm-hmm.
And come back, and I shared it with my seven buddies.
Uh-huh.
And so we had a little more money to go into San Francisco on Liberty.
And what did you think of San Francisco? Excuse me.
Oh, it was a... You know, an old country boy, it was a big town.
Mm-hmm.
From Treasure Island to over to Frisco to Pier 1, they run a water taxi.
Mm-hmm.
Run by the Navy, and then hold 200 boys, you know, you ride it. Didn't cost you nothing to ride over there. And we'd go uptown and go to some picture shows or stuff, and then there was a big old Pepsi-Cola USO center there, and you know, there's always sailors, because there's other ships that came in there, and there's always sailors up and down the street on Market Street.
Mm-hmm.
San Francisco, and when I finally got my orders, why, I was stationed right downtown in San Francisco.
Doing that, the radio?
That, yeah, that's where the Naval Radio Station was.
Okay.
And they paid us, we had to find our own rooms, and they paid us $105 a month for our board and room, plus our regular salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, if I remember right, one of the boys that went with me, well, there's three of them all worked in that station, but they had two rooms, and one of them was for two guys could use the same bedroom, you know, and there's a big room and an old rooming house, and kind of a fire trap place, but that was the best you could get a hold of them, and I think it cost us, seemed like it was $7 a week for that room.
Yeah.
And you could stop in a restaurant, and you could get a hamburger steak or something for $1.25.
Mm-hmm.
Breakfast for 50 cents.
It's amazing.
And when we checked into this, in the work in the morning, well, we worked 8 hours, and we had what we call chow runners. They'd come around and take our order, and we'd give them the money, and they'd go across the street and get our sandwiches and stuff. They didn't allow us to have a dinner break.
Okay, so that center was open. I mean, there were people working 24 hours a day.
Oh, yeah.
So there were three
8-hour shifts.
Okay, so did you always have the day one, or did
no,
you?
No. You went to work at 7 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon for 2 days. Then you had 24 hours off.
Okay.
Then you went from 3 till midnight for 2 days, and you had 24 hours off.
Okay.
And then you went from midnight to 7 in the morning for 2 days, and then you had a 48. So technically, you know, the Navy always figures out what your liberties are, was 24-hour or 48-hour. So technically, every 8 days, we had two 24s and a 48.
Okay. Well, that wasn't so bad, was it?
No. And I couldn't figure out why that they didn't leave them on a week at a time, and they claimed that it was affecting the people that worked up there and all that code, and affect them mentally.
Oh, okay. So basically what you were doing is just sitting there receiving the messages.
Yeah, and then we had to file them in a certain spot and had to figure out what priority they had, and if they had priority, top priority, well, we put them in a little tube and they went to another room.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew where every ship was in the Pacific.
Okay.
We had direct contact with Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
We had direct contact with Washington, D.C.
And how did you know their priority? How did you figure out the priority?
It was coded on top of the message.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. You know, and you got chewed out if you didn't get it in the right spot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I know one morning we come to work and the group that left ahead of us, they were 500 and some messages behind, and something was going on in Pearl Harbor somewhere, and that's when things had really get jammed up, is when something hot was going on overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And our captain, bet the captain that left, bet him, I forget what he bet him, oh, bet him $5 that we would be caught up by the time we went off shift. And we were.
Oh, that must have been a hectic day.
It was, you know, and they had teletype machines there. And a teletype machine is one key off on what a typewriter is.
Oh.
But sometimes when we wasn't busy, I'd go over there and I'd play with that teletype. But they had two civilians that worked on those teletypes most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that morning, that captain came over and he said, "How good are you on that teletype?" And I said, "I don't know how good I am." I said, "I just been playing with it." And he said, "You're going to set it this and all day." And I did. I just sat there. And they'd put messages up here and I'd type them all. I was good enough, I guess, it didn't screw up too bad.
So what kind of messages would you receive?
I don't know.
Because they were all in code.
All in code. Everything we our room didn't, most of it was printed out, and our job was to file them and determine, because there was another floor upstairs that broke down the code.
Okay.
In essence, my floor was kind of a plunky floor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, how did you view your job and the work you were doing as part of the overall war effort?
Well, that's the reason I say, you know, I just spent that time in that naval radio station. I think that was, you know, and technically everybody on in my room there, we didn't know really what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime we'd go out and hear it on the radio what had happened before we really knew.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because the people that broke the code down, they were sworn, you know, they couldn't walk out there and talk about it.
So they had gone to a different kind of school?
No.
Okay.
They had just been there longer and...
I see.
And it probably was the ability how well you could read the code and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what was your rank?
I wasn't in long enough now, just a seaman first class.
Okay. All right, so when you were in Gulfport, and then when you went out there, how did you receive mail? You wrote home to your parents?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Wrote letters home, and where the stamp went, and where you wrote free.
Okay. And then how would you receive mail? They would send it?
Oh, folks, you know, we had our address, and then we had mail call every day down there at the Gulf, and same way in Great Lakes, you had mail call every day.
Okay.
I don't, yeah, I think there was just, that was, you know, some of the boys, that was just their job to be mailmen on the base, and they come around to, and you know, you're, had your barracks number on the, on your address, you know, and so they just, when we got out of school in the evening, where all the mail was laying there on that table. The mailman had laid it on there for us.
Okay. So would you ride home maybe once a week or once?
Oh, yeah, at least.
Okay. All right.
At least.
But now your letters that you were writing home didn't have to go through a censor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Okay.
This boy I was telling you about got in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, some way or another, he got word to me on what ship he's going to. And I wrote him a letter back and told him he was going to Tientsin, China. But all that was blacked out.
Okay.
Because when we got home, he said, you know, that when you told me where we was going, he said all that was blacked out.
Mm-hmm. And why did you knew where all the ships were, so that's how you knew.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
When he told me what ship he's going to be on board, well, I just wrote him a letter. Mm-hmm. Of course, he didn't get the letter until he got to Tientsin, China. But
So you would write the letter but not put it in an envelope and seal it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so there were just people who, that was their job?
The letter to your folks, I don't think they were ever censored.
Okay. Right.
But the letter to maybe another person, especially like that one gone overseas where they were censored.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you think that the training that you received at Gulfport was adequate for what you did?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. All right. Do you remember a particular friend or a particular fellow Navy person or a particular experience?
Yeah, we had all the boys in the, 25 boys that were together, like this one Negro boy. He was from Miss Martha's Vineyard in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we all walked down to the bus to go into Gulfport one day. And back in those days, the Negroes had to sit in the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't going to let him, and he begged us to not create a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I'll go back there, no problem, fellas." And "No, if you're good enough to fight the war, you're set anywhere in this bus you want to."
Mm-hmm.
And that bus driver just got mad at us, and so finally all us white boys went sat in the back of the bus. And the bus driver wasn't going to move. And one of the boys went up there and grabbed him by the neck, and he said, "If you don't move this bus," he said, "get out of the seat and I'll drive it to town." Well, when we went up town, we about 3 miles into Gulfport, and picked up a lot of Negro women and stuff, and they lived in shanties.
Mm-hmm.
Picked them up, and they'd stand there and look a minute, and we had their seats. And the bus driver said, "Ladies, them sailors have got this bus occupied. Just sit anywhere you want." Yay!
Well, that would have been fairly unusual, wouldn't it, Hank?
Oh, yeah.
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 Okay. Well, that's a good story. Yeah.
Because, and I still feel that way. If he was good enough to wear the uniform, why wasn't he good enough to ride anywhere he wanted to on that bus?
Yeah. Well, I think that was a rarity because the United States government didn't feel that way.
No, they didn't.
No. Mm-mm. Any other story or a particular memory?
Oh, I had one of my buddies down there at Gulfport got married, and we had quite a deal and went out on, he had a cabin rented, and we went out to his place and had a celebration of his wedding and everything, and that was quite an experience.
Were most of the men unmarried or?
Yeah, there were several of them that were, especially from the Kansas City area, that were married when I was in boot camp, but most of the boys that I was with, and I don't remember of any of them being married except when this boy got married.
Mm-hmm. And their age would have been what?
Let's see, in 40, 45, I would have been 20 years old?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose most of them were 18 and 19. I was come awful close to being the oldest one in my hut down there in Gulfport.
And they came from all over the United States?
Yeah, yeah. I had one of my best friends was from Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
That I run around with quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
This typing instructor, he was from Kentucky, and he went home on leave, and when he come back, he called me up and said, "I got some extra money in my pocket," said, "let's go on Liberty."
Mm-hmm.
He didn't hold any rank over me or anything.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn a lot about people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And what did you learn?
Well, you learn of people's different ideas, surrounding across the United States. And it was I guess it was an eye-opener to an old farm kid out here in Western Kansas, where isolated and farther I'd been away from this area was Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And and to hear their stories of how they lived and things like that, it was different.
What surprised you the most?
Probably how well everybody got along.
Mm-hmm.
We did have problem with two other Negro boys in my company. They weren't particularly in my hunt, but they got caught. We call it raiding midnight small stores, and you'd leave your clothes hang out on the line, and they'd come there and somebody'd steal them. And why, I don't know, because our names are all stenciled on our clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, when we got down to taking a test one time, a couple of the boys, just like in high school, they went to another class and got the answers to a dang test, and they got caught.
Mm-hmm.
They were out and served the rest of the time down there working in a chow hall.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
No different than, you know, in high school, somebody was always cribbing something.
That's right. Was it hard to take orders and to obey?
I guess it wasn't for me so much, because I was brought up to got up in the morning, milked the cows, fed the chickens, and
mm-hmm.
and did this, and had to be ready to go to school at a certain time to catch the bus, and mm-hmm. and there was very seldom, very few of the boys. I thought one time we had a young man that could really call cadence, you know, and he'd get so sing-song, and we'd echo him, just like you hear on these deals.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we woke some gold braid up one time. We got turned in, and so we had to go march an extra hour because he didn't like what we was doing, and the captain of the base come out there and watch us march, and our guy was calling our cadence, and he said, and he stopped us, and he said, when you were marching the other day past this certain barracks, was that what you boys were doing? And this cadence counter said, sir, every time we go from one class to the other, that's the way we travel.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why don't you guys just take off and get back to your barracks? And he said, why? And he said, I'll go talk to that guy. He said, no reason to turn you in and put you on report.
Well, that was good. Yeah. So you were in San Francisco then until the war was...
No, until then. Well, the war... The big bomb had already been dropped before I ever got to San Francisco.
Oh.
I missed out on the big show in Frisco.
Okay. So where were you when it was the end of the war in Europe? Were you in Gulfport?
Well, you'll have to refresh me on the dates.
It was May 6th in 1945.
I was in Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay. Do you remember when that announcement came or anything?
Yeah. But when the big bomb was dropped on Japan, man, I'll tell you what, it was an uproar. I mean, everybody was celebrating down there in Gulfport.
Just simply because the war was finally over.
Yeah, it was going to end. You know, we knew it was going to be over.
Mm-hmm. What did people think about the atomic bomb? Because it had, of course, had been secret.
Well, everybody thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened, you know. And
mm-hmm.
as you look back and see how many lives it took away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I was home on leave when President Roosevelt died.
Oh, what do you remember about that?
Well, I was sitting there in the drugstore, and there was a fellow that was a couple years older than I was, and he was a lieutenant in the Navy, and he was on leave, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been in, gone to school together up here, you know, only about two or three, well, 3 years difference in it. And that Dwight Roberts I told you was mm-hmm. the person, his dad was a, walked in the drugstore and said President Roosevelt died.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, oh, and that was like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I remember Bob saying, Russ, you and I are lucky. And I said, why? And he said, I'll tell you what, if you were on base now, he said, them guys will be standing guard, and there'll be all kinds of deals every so many hours they're going to have to do. He said, you better enjoy this leave.
What did the community feel about Roosevelt as president, the people out here?
Oh, they thought he was a great man.
Okay. Do you know why? I mean,
well,
he was a Democrat.
Yeah, I know that, but we're going to go way back now.
Good.
When did he take office?
32.
Huh?
32.
My dad bought a Philco radio, operated with a 6-volt battery. And the reason I remember this so plain was that three of my dad's brother-in-laws come over and they wanted to hear President Roosevelt speak. And we had this radio, you know, so they all sat there and listened to it, you know, and then the farm program started, and I had a sister that was still in high school, and one of Dad's brother-in-laws became, when they were signing up the farmers and everything, getting all their history and stuff, but had a little schoolhouse over there, and Uncle John hired my sister to be a typist for him, you know, and of course, he had four or five girls there getting all the information. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, paid her like 50 cents a day to sit there and run a typewriter. And back in that day in 1932 and 33, that was, especially in 33, that was big money, mm-hmm. you know.
Now, why were they signing the farmers up? You mean for a Farm Recovery Act or something?
Yeah, because we were, farmers were absolutely broke out here, you know. We had gone through the dust storms and were absolutely raising no crops.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and if it wasn't, and that's how this, and this farm program has been gone on ever since the Roosevelt area. That's what I, mm-hmm. what I remember about it.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the Dirty 30s? You would have been...
I remember mm-hmm. waking up in this house that we lived in, and I didn't think it was all that bad of a house.
Mm-hmm.
And the dirt blues had all gone bad, and my mom would come in and wake me up, and she'd roll the covers back gently.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want me to make the dust, and then the minute I got out of bed, well, she put the covers clear back up over, so because it may blow all day long, and so it wasn't no use of shaking the covers, dirt off the covers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the windows weren't built like they are nowadays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they then went and clear up and stuff. Why, we'd fold the covers up real gently and take them outside and hang them on a clothesline and
mm-hmm.
take a stick and beat the dust down.
Now, were you able to have a garden? Did you raise your own food?
Yeah, Mom had a garden, and we had as I look back, I was proud of my dad. We had meat on the table at least one day, one meal a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe chicken, but butchered a couple of hogs, and when a calf was born, it was a bull calf. Why, that calf never got out of the barn until he weighed 400 pounds, took him down and butchered him.
Oh.
And then hauled the meat back out there, and my mom had a pressure cooker, and she'd the roasts and stuff she'd cut up into inch and a half squares and put in the fruit in the curd jars and put them in that pressure cooker and
mm-hmm.
put them down in the cellar underneath the house and
mm-hmm.
rendered our own lard.
Mm-hmm.
Always had chickens.
Mm-hmm.
So
what kind of chores were you asked to do on the farm? You milked?
I had milk. We had always had four cows, but I had two cows that were, you know, and they were gentle and everything, and that's the reason I got to milk them.
Mm-hmm.
We had hogs, you know, and they always had to carry feed to them and made sure they had water. And,
mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, when a blizzard come, why, the cows never got out of the barn. My dad was so particular and pampered them so bad that we carried the water to them
mm-hmm.
instead of drying them out to the stock tank. We carried the water.
What did you feed, for instance, the cows during the Dirty 30s when you weren't raising much? Did you have a pasture? Or?
No, we had a pasture, but there wasn't much to eat in the pasture in the wintertime, you know. And
mm-hmm.
Dad always managed to raise a little feed and put some up of some kind and sold the milk and, I mean, the cream and the eggs.
Mm-hmm. And at Houck's?
Huh?
At Houck's here in Cimarron? Or?
Well, the cream, we hauled a lot of cream in the house in
uh-huh.
that old hotel.
Mm-hmm.
But the eggs usually went to Trainer's IGA store, and he bought the eggs, and then if there's any money left after the groceries was bought, but Dad always bought a 100-pound sack of bran, which is wheat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the used to call it shorts and bran.
Mm-hmm.
The shorts would be a better grade of feed, but always give them cows a a pound coffee can of brand every morning and every night, you know. Mm-hmm. And he always had feed, and I remember he'd buy some feed. And I guess how he paid for it was from them government checks he got from the government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, we better get back to World War II. We might come back to that, but I need to finish these questions. When you got out of the Navy and came home, did you know what you were going to do? Did you want to come home?
Yeah, because while I was gone, my dad was trying to run the farm and everything out here. And a brother in Kansas City come out and helped him that summer. But my mom wrote and told me that dad was coming home from the tractor sick. Mm-hmm. And I went over to the chaplain and see if I could get a 15-20 day leave so I could come out, that was in September, so I could drill wheat for him.
Okay.
And the chaplain said, well, he said, go you one better. He said, you get your mom to get a couple guys to write a couple letters for her, and that your dad is unable to continue the farm, and send it to the congressman. Well, it took from September to January for that to all catch up with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I pretty well knew that, you know, when dad's mom's, they were getting up there. Of course, back in them days, 60 was old.
Right, yeah.
And I'm 80 now.
You're 80. Well, I guess you would be if this is, yeah. Yeah, 60 was old, wasn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I knew that I'd probably farm, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. And where was your farm located?
Well, we lived 10 miles north and a mile west on the Pole Line Road.
Okay. Okay. And there was a school out there that you went to?
No, I
You came into Cimarron.
Went all my years to Cimarron.
Okay. Okay. How do you think your experience in the Navy changed you?
Respect for others, being on time at a certain place at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
Being, I guess what you call being prompt.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, you learned how to take care of your own clothes and stuff, and you washed your own clothes by hand.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
They had big old wooden troughs there with water running, and they give you a scrub brush and soap.
Were these white?
Huh?
Were these white?
Yeah, we had white uniforms.
Oh.
Yeah, when we were in Mississippi, when you went on Liberty, you were required to wear white uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to then iron?
No.
No.
The way you pressed your clothes, you put them underneath your mattress.
Oh, okay.
If you wanted something ready pressed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but the Navy taught you to roll those clothes real tight.
Oh, when they were wet?
No,
when they were dry.
Dry, you know, and that kept your, because everything you had went in a sea bag about this big around, about this tall.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you wore.
So you didn't have much? Two uniforms, three uniforms?
Oh, you had, they call them dungarees, which are Levi's, and a regular old farm-looking shirt, you know. Mm-hmm. Blue. We had, were issued three of them and three pair of dungarees, two white uniforms and two blue uniforms.
Okay.
A big old pea coat.
Mm-hmm.
And a smaller jacket.
Okay. Any kind of a hat?
Yeah. Always had them white sailor hats.
Okay. And what kind of shoes?
A pair of, lace top shoes that come up to about here, and a mm-hmm. pair of dress shoes.
Okay. And you wore the lace top when you were working?
Yeah. The only time you wore your dress shoes is when you went out on Liberty, or mm-hmm. or if they usually every Saturday they always had an inspection, you know, where all each company went in, and
mm-hmm.
the captain of the base would walk them down the lines, and if somebody didn't look right, well, they had a guy follow and put you on report, and you couldn't have Liberty.
Okay. Okay. What did you have, if you only had this sea bag, did you have many personal items?
Well, they had a little ditty bag where you had your razor and your shaving soap and your, you know, and the toothbrush and all that kind of stuff was in a little ditty bag. When you got ready to travel, if you didn't want to take, if you, you tied the little ditty bag on and you had your own hammock and your own mattress, and that was all, you had the, you put the mattress, which is about yay thick, and you put that in the hammock, and rolled it, tied it up real tight, and then your hammock went over your sea bag, and that, and when you